Good morning and happy new year. Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, whether you were out late bringing in 2015 or if you were up early already working on this year's resolutions, the writer Anne Lamott is here for you.
I tell the truth, though. I'm a truth teller. And the hugest experience spiritually you can have with another person is for them to listen and to say, me too.
We'll replay our recent conversation with the writer Anne Lamott later in the show. And we've got some other recent favorites for New Year's Day, a conversation about the clothes you hang on to long after you stop wearing them and the strength you get from them, including a story from Orange is the New Black writer Piper Kerman. Also, a critical roundtable discussion on the end of adulthood in popular culture. And we'll hear from the legendary sportscaster Al Michaels today, who has logged more hours hosting live TV than any other human. But maybe you know my first guest, Cheryl Strayed, through the movie that's out right now, Wild, starring Reese Witherspoon. Well, it was a book by Cheryl Strayed first, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. It's the story of a young woman who takes off to hike more than 1,000 miles of the PCT over 3 months in 1995, just as she felt like her life was falling apart. Wild is a great example of the most profound kind of travel, travel as a quest. And we've talked about this here on the show before. A few years ago, we had the photographer Annie Leibovitz, who wrote a book called Pilgrimage, and we took calls specifically on the related idea of the pilgrimage. Many of you, it turned out, had gone on one.
I had made a pilgrimage to Granada, Spain, to visit the house of Federico García Lorca.
I have two pilgrimage places, one in honor of the God-sent abolitionist, Reverend John Brown. I visit the former federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry.
We went to Georgia O'Keeffe's house, really viscerally felt like I was in her space. I was inside a photograph.
I visited a small cemetery with 40 graves in it on land that was purchased by some Scots-Irish ancestors of mine.
Some excerpts from your pilgrimage stories there, and now to Cheryl Strayed, who wrote the memoir Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl, thanks so much for coming on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And as you write in Wild, and as the subtitle suggests, you were at a low point in your life. You were in your 20s. You had recently lost your mother, and your marriage had ended. What made you think an 1,100-mile hike could change that, or were you even conscious that that was a goal?
Oh, absolutely, that was the goal. I had reached a low point in my life. My mom died suddenly of cancer at the age of 45 when I was a senior in college, and she was a senior in college, too, as it turns out. And it really began, just a lot of difficult things in my life. And I was in my early 20s, and that's already a difficult time for many people. They're trying to figure out who they are. And I really, looked up when I was about 26 and said, I can't go on this way. I have to gather myself and become the person I know I'm meant to be. And I needed to do something to sort of shake my life up. But I think, obviously, that's what travel does. You know, when we go out of the familiar and into the wild, and I did that literally, out of the comfort zone and into those places where you can discover who you really are. So I just decided I needed to take a big, incredible journey, and it ended up being walking for 3 months on the Pacific Crest Trail.
So you did it very consciously with that in mind. And, of course, you wrote a whole book to answer this question I'm about to ask you. But did you find essentially what you were looking for since you set out so consciously with the goal you just described? Or did you find something different?
I think that we always find something different. We set an intention. We're looking for a particular thing, and any good journey takes us on an adventure we couldn't have expected. I think that I found, in a bigger sense, what I was looking for, but I didn't know the route by which I would get it. My hike ended up being so much more physically difficult than I imagined it would be. You know, before I set out, I had this kind of Hollywood movie reel in my mind of, sitting there every evening watching the sunset and weeping over its beauty and feeling connected to the universe. And instead what I got, I got that, but I also got a lot of, real trials, physical trials, pain, deep solitude. I went the first 8 days of my hike without even seeing another human being. And out of those challenges, things arose, and I really learned all of those things that I needed to learn in order to do that thing I set out to do.
And I wonder if Kira in Brooklyn is especially identifying with this, considering what I think she's going to talk about. Kira, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi there, Brian. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Great. Well, my quest involved the sudden death of my sister. She actually died while attending the Burning Man Festival out in Nevada, and it was one of those, very unexpected things. It took a year because Burning Man only happens once a year, but by the time the next year came around, I kind of dropped everything in New York, quit my job, left my apartment, left everything I had going here, and kind of made my pilgrimage to Burning Man in my sister's memory.
I'm so sorry you lost your sister.
Thanks.
And so am
I. What was that like to go back and be in the place of her death?
Well, I'd never been there before, so I kind of knew a little bit about what to expect. It's all about community, and a lot of people are going there in a spiritual way. They actually build a temple at Burning Man, and I was able to make a shrine for her there and actually had her ashes there. They burn the whole thing at the end, so actually part of her ashes kind of will always be a part of that part of the desert. So it was really cathartic for me to go back and feel like I could kind of be where she'd spent her last week.
Kira, thanks so much. It's hard to get more profound than that right off the bat. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure it's hard to talk about, too. Cheryl, did you ask her what it was like because you were wondering whether it would be more cathartic or more re-traumatizing?
I mean, I think that in some ways, even though Kira had never been to Burning Man, she was, obviously visiting a place that had, has a great importance in her life and her family's life. And, I do think I think catharsis and trauma can be really close together. I mean, part of catharsis is reaching into the dark places and being there and being witness to the saddest things in our lives. I don't think that that's to be avoided. I think that's the only way to get to catharsis.
Jessica in Jersey City, tell us about your quest.
Well, my quest stemmed from childhood. I was raised, as a lot of us were, on Little House on the Prairie, both the books and TV. And I was between jobs in May of 2004 during the cicada invasion, if you recall that. And I decided, I had 6 days between jobs. I decided to take my Mini Cooper and drive to Mansfield, Missouri, where Mrs. Wilder wrote the books, and drive back. So I spent 2 days each way driving and a day and a half in Mansfield, Missouri, and it was very emotional. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories of my childhood, and it was just a very soul-stirring, deep experience.
Were other people doing something similar?
There were a lot of school groups, but I noticed a couple of, approaching middle-aged single women looking a little lost. And upon connecting with two of the three of them, they all were doing the same thing. We all felt a little embarrassed until we realized how deep a connection we'd all had to these books as children. And we felt vindicated.
That's an awesome story. Thank you very much. Cheryl Strayed.
I especially love to hear that because I'm a writer. I love it that that your hero is a writer.
Where should people go in 50 years to remember you and make that connection with your books?
That's been one of the most amazing things to come out of Wild is we don't have to wait 50 years. There are people right now as we speak hiking the Pacific Crest Trail and other trails around the world because they were inspired by Wild.
Right, absolutely. And I wonder if these words mean anything or mean anything different. If you were on a quest and that last caller was on a pilgrimage, that pilgrimage to the Wilder House, but you were on a quest, which was to go figure something out and find something new and break new ground. Do you see a meaning? You're a writer. As a writer, do you see a different nuance, a nuanced difference between those words that has meaning?
I do. I think that there are some, some striking similarities. You are ultimately, I think, seeking solace and personal growth on both those kinds of journeys. But one, you know, the quest is that you're trying to answer the questions. I mean, there's that quest means question, and you're really trying to find the answer to something. In my own case in Wild, it really came down to, how can I live without my mother? I had lost, when she died, the essential person in my life. How can I live without her? And I found the answer to that question. I think a pilgrimage is to revisit something you already know and see what more you know about it, to honor in some ways the essence of who you are. And so they're linked, but slightly different intentions.
I think Jean in St. Louis went on a quest. Hi, Jean. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. And I can really relate to what Cheryl's saying about being on a pilgrimage and trying to find that thing inside you. And in 2011, in fact, it's 3 years ago this week, I walked off a corporate job, a middle-aged, divorced mother of four who'd finished raising kids. And mine was also, unfortunately, motivated by the death of my brother. And I'd lost two brothers inside a few short years. And I'd always intended to go back and do this road trip with them and to revisit the places where I'd lived. I was a journalist. I'd lived around the country. And I got to a point, Brian, where I just said, I cannot do this life another day. And I quit my job. I called my kids all across the country and said, I'm bugging out. I took my dog, and we traveled 8,600 miles around the country to revisit every place and every person I'd known and loved in my life.
Wow.
And there was another mystery. There had been some very, frankly, everybody has heartache, and there had been some very arduous times that my children and I had gone through some really difficult things. But I had a half-brother from my biological father whom I had never seen and didn't know where he was. And when my brother died in Albuquerque and I had missed the opportunity to go back and to spend more time with him, because, you know, we're distracted. We're distracted by jobs and mortgages and obligations. And I figured out that, you know, living with regret was worse than living with fear. And I thought, screw it, what do I have to lose? I've worked all my life to try to keep a roof over my head, but time's running out. And so I did this trip. I went from St. Louis in a big circle around the country. And I tell you what, I found my brother in Northern California and had never laid eyes on him. And the entire trip, frankly, changed my life.
Living with regret is worse than living with fear.
And you learn that, you know, the hard way with best intentions. Like, I wish I'd spent more time with them. I wish that I had stopped what I was doing and gone and done this when I thought about it. And, you know, I think the older we get and the more tied we get to, you know, our responsibilities and our obligations, it can be very paralyzing. And my dog, in fact, was the inspiration. I had this epiphany moment out in my front lawn when she wouldn't go after a cat because of her invisible collar or the electrical fence collar around her neck.
Right.
And she wants to go, you know, chase this cat, and she stopped short. And I'm sitting there on my front porch the day that my brother passed away, and I thought, the batteries in her collar are dead. She could go after that thing that she wants, but she's afraid. And that was the day that I said, I don't care. I'm leaving. And, in fact, I wrote a book about the trip, and I did a Kickstarter campaign. And I was 56 years old, so I'm not the typical Kickstarter demo.
Yeah. So this is such an amazing story on so many levels. And I want to ask about one little piece of it. Because so here are all these conditions of your life that you've described. But the thing you went to do was to try to see everybody you've ever known in your life and every place you've ever visited in the past, if I heard you right.
Yeah.
Why that? Why were you looking for everybody you've ever known? Why was that the trip?
Because I felt like it was the thing that I longed for. I longed to go to North Carolina and Texas, New Mexico, California. I'd lived in all these places. And I wanted to find cousins I hadn't seen in 40 years to tell them that I loved them. And I wrote about this in the book, that as much as people want to go on these journeys, and I get it absolutely down to my DNA, but the folks that you go see, it makes a difference to them. If you go back and you visit them and you say, you matter to me. And I just think it's so important for us to seize those opportunities to go back and visit those folks and say, you made a difference in my life.
Incredible. Cheryl, you want to talk to your fellow memoirist at all?
Well, I just would love to read your book. But I also feel, you know, I relate to so much of what you're saying. So much of my ability to go on that hike when I did had to do with what you just said. You know, I decided not to let fear rule me.
Right.
So often
right.
people say, how could you go out there by yourself? You know, I was alone in the wilderness, you know, for 94 days, and I was really alone. I mean, this was very remote wilderness. And they, you know, people ask, weren't you afraid? And yes, I sometimes was afraid, but mostly what I said to myself is I am not afraid. I decided that fear would not be my ruler. And I think, of course, you know, we always have to, you know, take precautions and all of those things. I'm not talking about, you know, just throwing yourselves into the world. I'm saying, you know, so many of us don't do the things we really want to do because we decide to let fear be our ruler. And I just wasn't willing to do that. It sounds like you weren't either.
Jean, awesome. Thank you so much. You've added so much.
Sure. My book is Off the Leash.
Off the Leash.
Off the Leash,
Jean
okay.
Ellen Watley. And Cheryl, you're an inspiration, and I get where you're coming from. And I you know, bless you for all your good work. And I appreciate the opportunity
Thank
to be
you.
On the show.
And Jean, what was your last name? I think I stepped on it.
That's all right. So Jean Ellen Watley, and my book is Off the Leash, How My Dog Inspired Me to Quit My Job, Pet My Car, and Take a Road Trip Across America to Reclaim My Life.
Thank you, and good luck.
Thanks.
John in Queens, can you top that?
Well, a little bit. I've been to all 3,142 counties in the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
40 years ago, just after I got out of graduate school, a friend and I took an 8,000-mile trip in a Volkswagen. And when I passed into my 49th state, you know, I got this crazy idea. Well, I've been to 49 states. 50 will be easy. And then I took a look at a map of the United States with all the counties. And I said, you know, that's a quest. And so last September, I visited my two last counties up in the Aleutians. I went to Aleutians West census area, and I went to Aleutians East Borough. And it has been amazing. Actually, you and I have something in common, Brian, because
yeah.
in 1990 I called you and talked to you about the fact that you and I stayed at the same hotel in Denali National
oh,
Park.
Oh, gosh, I remember that.
And
in fact, I remember because the show,
I've
I'll tell you.
A little bit more traveling.
Wow, that's an incredible story. John, I'll just tell the listeners that the show was just 1 year old at that time. And that was like my first little taste of fame in a way that it was that somebody was actually listening, you know, and that it was getting out beyond the four corners of, you know, the most listened to blocks for public radio in New York. Because that was really my first vacation in the history of doing the show. And my wife and I went to Alaska, and we thought we were getting as far away as we could possibly get, finding the dirt roads and all of that. And the clerk well, I don't think we met, but the clerk at the hotel said, oh, you're Brian Lehrer from the radio. A guy here saw your name in the guest book, and he's a listener. And I was like,
that was me.
Holy moly at Denali.
Mm-hmm.
So, and well, then you've gone. So, John, after visiting all how many counties in America?
3,142. It fluctuates slightly. Things change again and now and again.
So is it like notches on the wall, and I did it, and I did it, and I did it, and
no,
I can check this one off, or is it deeper?
The most important thing about it was the travel. And, in fact, I'm not trying to promote anything. I just wrote a 13-page essay about it, but I'm trying to shop around to magazines and stuff. And I call it a book of 3,142 pages. I mean, I went to the leper colony in Molokai, which is a separate county, and I had to hike down the 1,600-foot cliff path to get there.
Wow.
Of course, I was in Unalaska, which is also called Dutch Harbor, which was incredible. And then I went to a place called Cold Bay. That was my absolute last county. Turned out to be the bleakest place I've been. But I'm so glad to have done all those things. I've listened to old men in 1,000 different restaurants for breakfast, because that's where old men go in the morning, talking about local politics, local life in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Georgia and all over. I've had amazing epiphanies in places, and it's been just the most wonderful thing to do. In the meantime, I've also been to all seven continents. I have hiked the Inca Trail. I have been to the Serengeti Plains. I have been in all three of the big pyramids at Giza. I've been very lucky. I love to travel. I was an officer in the Navy in the 60s, and I've been around the world twice and things like that. So been lucky.
I thought I was good for sleeping in 45 states. Now I feel like a pipsqueak. John, thank you very much. That is awesome. And Cheryl Strayed, we're running out of time, but I know that you are going to read something for us from your book. This is a passage about the emotional journey you were on that Wild was based on, and I think you're talking about the halfway point of your trip when you had just passed a deer who reacted to you calmly. Do you want to set this up anymore?
Sure. Well, yeah, it is the midpoint of the journey, and I think the previous caller just used that word epiphany. And, you know, I think most journeys, what we find is we have epiphanies along the way. And so this was a moment where I guess I felt an opening. I felt that I was getting what I went out there to get. I gazed out over the darkening land. There were so many amazing things in this world. They opened up inside of me like a river. I laughed with the joy of it, and the next minute I was crying my first tears on the PCT. I cried and I cried and I cried. I wasn't crying because I was happy. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I wasn't crying because of my mother or my father or Paul. I was crying because I was full. California streamed behind me like a long silk veil. I didn't feel like a big fat idiot anymore, and I didn't feel like an Amazonian queen. I felt fierce and humble and gathered up inside, like I was safe in this world, too. And so really that was just a moment where, you know, I was out there. I'd been hiking about 50 days by that point. So many hard things had happened to me. And I'd never cried until there was this moment of beauty, of fullness. I could see that I was getting what I'd come for, which is really extraordinary.
So beautiful. And Cheryl Strayed, thanks so much. Weren't the calls amazing?
They were. I loved listening to all of their stories. I wish we were all sitting around the table. We could talk more. I wanted to ask them all questions.
We'll have to do this for, you know, a weekend sometime.
Yeah.
With 100,000 other people.
Or you could all go hiking with me. We could talk a lot in the woods.
I like it. Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the stories behind the clothes we hang on to even after we stop wearing them, including one story from a very special guest, Orange is the New Black writer, Piper Kerman. Stay with us.
Cause it's hard. Yes, it's hard. Say goodbye to my clothes. My clothes. Nobody knows.
New York Times columnist David Carr loves his white shirt with New York written upside down. Roseanne Cash loves her father's purple tuxedo shirt. Marina Abramovich will never get rid of a pair of boots she wore to walk the Great Wall of China. Emily Spivak, creator of the Smithsonian's blog Threaded and founder of Shop Well With You, which is about women with cancer and clothing, is now the author of a book called Worn Stories, W-O-R-N, Worn Stories, Sartorial Memoirs from the People I Mentioned and many others. Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black, will join us shortly to talk about her contribution to the book. But let's welcome the author, Emily Spivak. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So this book, Emily, I see came out of a project you started back in 2010. What was that?
Well, I was looking in my own closet and I was seeing an archive of memories and of experiences. Whenever I'd go travel somewhere, I'd stop at a flea market and pick up a shirt or a slip or, you know, something that would be, and usually a piece of clothing, that would be a memento of that experience. So I was looking in my own closet. I was seeing that they were... It was full of stories as much as it was full of clothing. And I started writing some stories about my own clothes. But I quickly realized I was far more interested in other people's stories than I was in my own. So I turned my attention to to asking other people. And then I began the website, WernStories.com, always knowing I wanted it to actually be a book. You could always see it as a book.
And we see in this book images of worn clothing and their corresponding essays. Just flipping through the book, it looks like mostly shirts, sneakers, sweaters, like really basic things. Do you notice patterns about the submissions?
Well, there's really very little that's fancy or that's name brand. Everything is really well worn. All the garments were sent to me and photographed, and you could tell that they were well loved. Holes, rips, stains, they've all, you know, because clothing tends to be pretty porous, they took on the wear. You could tell that they were very well loved.
And any recurring themes that you've noticed emerge from these stories that go with the clothes?
I mean, I think I was always just incredibly surprised by what the stories would be. You know, they're the typical, very sentimental stories, things that were passed down from grandparent to parent. But then there were just also the sort of more shocking stories, more surprising stories, you know, something that was worn to read poetry to Obama at the White House, or something that you, you know, wore when you were kidnapped. You know, there were really a wide swath of stories.
One of the essays in Emily Spivak's sartorial memoir was written by Piper Kerman, whose own memoir was adapted into the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Piper Kerman joins us now by phone to talk about her submission. Hi, Piper. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me, Brian. And hello, Emily.
Hi, Piper.
And I see you wrote about the outfit you wore to your final court appearance. Will you describe it for the audio audience?
The essay that I submitted for Emily's book is about the skirt suit that I wore for my sentencing. I thought that it would be my final court appearance. In fact, my final court, what I hope is my final court appearance in life, was in an orange jumpsuit. But this was my sentencing, sort of the day that I was presenting myself for final judgment. And so I wrote about that outfit. That's the only occasion in which I've worn that skirt suit. And I have it still, of course, and I doubt I'll ever wear it again.
So it's easy to imagine why a person would want to keep things that remind them of good memories. It's a little harder to understand why some of us hold on to clothes that remind us of darker times, like the day of your sentencing. Why did you?
I think it's just such a singular moment in your life. I think it would be a mistake to try to put your mistakes out of your mind and to try to avoid those watershed moments in your life, even though they might not be happy moments or things that you feel sentimental about. You know, I think one of the fascinating things about Emily's book is that clothing represents these choices that we make about how we're going to present ourselves to the world. A day that you're appearing in court, I don't care if it's for a divorce proceeding or for, you know, criminal sentencing or other really important, significant things that take place in court, that's a moment when people really want to represent themselves in a very specific way. And so this skirt suit, again, is sort of very unusual. It's actually a vintage piece. It's from the 1950s. And what it really reminds me of is sort of something that a Hitchcock heroine would wear. It's really an atypical piece of clothing for me personally. And yet it that choice, which I made with my defense attorney, you know, I had several options, which is really different than most criminal defendants who have very little choice about what they'll wear in court. You know, somehow that choice about how you want to represent yourself at this really important pivotal moment is something that I think is worth sort of holding on to and reminding yourself of occasionally, taking it out of the box, even though you might never put that piece of clothing on again.
That's so interesting. And Emily, it's not just Piper. There's another essay in the book by Kathleen Drohan, a writer and publicist from Brooklyn. She wrote about a Harvard Med School sweatshirt given to her by the doctor who took care of her mother on the day she died. So, you know, people hold on to items that remind them of emotionally difficult times.
Right. The book really ranges, and that was important to me, to collect stories that, you know, we wear clothing every day of our lives, and we absorb the experiences through our clothing, good things and bad, funny things, serious things. So I wanted to really, I wanted the book to represent that range of stories and that range of life experiences.
Piper, I guess you've seen the whole book. Did anyone else's submission catch your eye or your imagination or your heart?
Oh, the book is so beautiful and it has such a rich array of stories. I love David Carr's writing, and I truly love that essay, not to repeat the one that you singled out. Oh, there's an amazing story from the guy from Dapper Dan, and I'm sure Emily can give you more detail on how she got that story. But Dapper Dan, you know, for anyone who's an old-school rap fan, they will know who Dapper Dan is.
Right, and he his story is about a suede fur-lined coat that he's had since the 70s, and really he continues to wear it to this day, but represents his up and coming, you know, as he was sort of building his reputation in Harlem in the 70s, 80s, as he opened his boutique, the iconic Dapper Dan boutique, and the coat that stayed with him, the whole way. As he was designing other people's clothes, this one still represented who he was.
Piper Kerman, before you go, we did find a clip from season 2 of Orange is the New Black that might be relevant to this moment.
Hey, is this all my stuff?
Your stuff.
Why do I have so many clothes? My God. Did I really think that I needed all of these? Oh, my God. Oh, my God, my cashmere sweater.
Do you remember that scene?
I do remember that scene. That's from Piper's Furlough in season 2. I have to tell you, when I came home from prison, I had that self-same feeling, like, wow, all this stuff when you exist with a very curtailed, you know, range of physical things like you do in prison, you come back to the outside world and it's very overwhelming. I will say, when my husband came to get me from prison, I asked him to bring me a cashmere sweater to change into.
And it made it in that reference into this series. Piper Kerman, author of Orange is the New Black and contributor to Emily Spivak's book, Worn Stories, Sartorial Memoirs. Thanks so much for a great contribution to the show today.
Thank you.
And Emily's going to stay and listen to some of our listeners' contributions for what they might put in a Worn Stories collection. Hale in Freeport, you're on WNYC. Hello, Hale.
Hello, how you doing?
All
great
right.
Show.
Thank you.
I still have my platform shoes that I used to wear going to nightclubs back in the 70s, the high disco shoes. And what would happen if you had a fist fight over a girl, you had to take your shoes off because if someone would punch you, you'd fall down on the shoes. And then we were at a show at the Flushing World's Fair, Flushing Park, and we bought tie-dye outfits for me and my workers because we were setting up, and we looked crazy. These tie-dyes were made from these African people. They were multi-colored. They were really great. The whole suits were $50, all three of us. We wore them the whole day, the whole night. I still have that suit today, and every once in a while I wear it when you go into a room. Everybody asks about it, and it reminds me of having that day, and we wound up at the beach, and we were playing strip poker, and everybody got naked on the beach in Jones Beach. And
I'm going to leave it there and get some other folks on, but there's the irony. He remembers the clothes he was wearing to strip out of them.
Yes, and, I think that's the thing. There's scent, there's taste, and then there are also sometimes just the garment that we have that really reminds us of that exact moment in time. And that's why we hold on to these things.
You know, we were talking to Piper about the dark moments that you might save clothing from, and I didn't know if we would get anything like that on the phones. But let's talk to Jane in Wachung, who's calling in. Hi, Jane. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Piper.
It's Emily Spivak with us. Yeah, no, you tell us. It sounds like you're going to have a lot of, you're going to need a lot of courage to tell this story.
Well, about 35 years ago, a man came to my apartment building who said he was a policeman and showed me the badge, and he came in and he raped me and nearly killed me. And when he was leaving after the crime, he took a silk blouse I had and cleaned himself off with it, a blouse that I was about to take to the cleaners. And the police took the blouse as evidence, and they cut a hole in it, and then they gave it back to me. And I have it hanging in my closet. It represents a lot to me. I mean, the whole incident obviously was traumatic, but I took it and reframed, with help from therapists and my husband, reframed it in as positive a way I could, in that I survived it. And if I could survive that, I could survive anything. And along with surviving it, it changed a lot of my priorities in life in terms of what was important to me. Things that upset me before didn't upset me anymore because they were trivial.
It's an incredible story.
Absolutely incredible.
Well, thank you.
And you, where do you keep the shirt, if I may ask?
In my closet, in my main closet. I have a,
really? You know, so it's just hanging there with the stuff that you actually wear all the time?
Yes, I don't wear it.
Right, but it's a reminder to you of perspective.
Yes, exactly. Of putting things, that's the word, putting things in perspective of what's important and what isn't.
Well, I think that...
And of my inner strength.
I think that clothing can, I mean, it serves as a symbol. It serves as a reminder to us, you know, for better or for worse, as Piper was saying and as you're saying. And I think that it can be something that, you know, clothing does have an opportunity to be therapeutic as well. So this seems like it's serving that purpose.
Thank you for sharing that, Jane. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And I know all the listeners do. Bye-bye. Waldo in Union City. You're on WNYC. Hi, Waldo.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Where's Waldo? Union City. What's your story?
Yeah, the garments or the things that I keep that have sentimental value are my boots. I came to this country, this beautiful country, 15 years ago, and those boots are the ones that I wore from Central America, from El Salvador, and all the way down to here. And it's a bittersweet reminder of how hard it is to get here. I spent 4 days in the desert with no food and very, very little water, wherever I can find it. And I always kept on pushing. I always kept on pushing. And now, you know, I am in the military. I gladly served this country for receiving me. And I have a beautiful home, a beautiful family with my kids. And my dream of being here and being more than whatever it is that I had, you know, escaping from that poverty and violence in my country, I look at those boots, and every time things get tough, or you think that things get tough, I just look at them and I remember, you know, just one more step. Just keep on pushing, another step.
Wow.
And now, you know, I tell my daughter, you know, I try to teach her that everything is earned, not given. And I tell her, look, honey, you know, this is what happened, and this is how, you know, I got here. So my family has a very strong sense of, you know, not making a big deal over very small things. Mm-hmm.
And the boots represent one step and another step and another step, in addition to the fact that you were wearing them when you arrived in this country. And I get that. Oh, the emotion in your voice, Waldo. Emily?
Well, and I think that, you know, we are... There's something about clothing. You know, we're attuned to the idea of fashion and that fashion is something that is maybe more fleeting. But I think that we can all really relate to clothing. Since we're all putting it on, it's not necessarily the stylistic element, but it's also the functional element. And there's a, you know, his story, Waldo's story, very much about, you know, the functional element, but also, and the durability of garments and the way that they stick around. And that also feels important to me. I mean, sometimes they show their wear, but they're going to be there for a while.
Waldo, thank you so much. And as we run out of time, my guest has been Emily Spivak. She created the Smithsonian's fashion history blog, Threaded, and now has written the book, Worn Stories, a collection of first-person essays about the items in our closets that mean the most to us. And you're still collecting submissions, right?
Absolutely. On wornstories.com, you can actually submit your own story. And I welcome everyone to submit their story. Also, you can tweet or Instagram your story using the hashtag Worn Stories, and that will also wind up on the Worn Stories website. So please, I'm continuing to collect them.
Great. Yes. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
We'll continue after the news with a roundtable discussion on whether adulthood in general is over
in our culture, at least in the world according to Mad Men, The Sopranos, Girls, and Louie. And no matter how good you feel today, the writer Anne Lamott is coming up, and she will make you feel better, I promise. And Sunday Night Football sportscaster Al Michaels. That's all coming up here on The Brian Lehrer Show as we continue with some of our recent favorites. But first, the latest news, live right now from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and who says no one reads long form anymore? Perched near the top of the New York Times most read list is a long piece from the magazine titled The Death of Adulthood in American Culture. Written by film critic A.O. Scott, it's part riff, part historical dive, part ode to a cultural artifact that he sees us lacking in, grown-ups. It's launched a raft of responses and counter-theories, like from New York Magazine's Adam Sternberg and The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum. So let's get these big brains off Twitter, off the written page, onto more than 140 characters of spoken word here in our radio station, here together. Three of our favorite culture critics, Tony Scott, Adam Sternberg, and Emily Nussbaum. Welcome back, all of you, to WNYC.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I want to actually begin with a clip of audio relevant to the article. This is radio, so we pull audio. I'm sure most everyone will recognize these very serious men.
That's all of life. It's the cycle. It's solution, dissolution, just over and over and over.
Even though success is a reality, its effects are temporary. You get hungry even though you've just eaten.
Growth, then decay, then transformation.
People misinterpret. They think you're weak. They see an opportunity.
Alpha male.
You're happy because you're successful, for now. But what is happiness? It's a moment before you need more happiness.
I liked it. I was good at it. I was alive.
People see only what you allow them to see.
Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing.
Characters, Tony Soprano, Don Draper of Mad Men, and Walter White of Breaking Bad. And Tony Scott, you're right, their deaths were and will be a culmination and a conclusion. Tony, Walter, and Don are the last of the patriarchs. So I ask, considering their outsized flaws, is that a bad thing?
No, not at all. Actually, just to clear up, this piece has been interpreted in some places and by some people, maybe even someone here, as a kind of lament for the loss of adulthood and patriarchal authority. And it's not really that at all. And I think one of the things that makes those three figures so interesting and so significant is precisely that they're kind of rotten father figures. They're corrupt. They're dishonest. They're sociopathic. They're terrible. And all of them are in some way, I think, struggling to hold on to, and ultimately, I think, failing to hold on to. Although in the case of Walter White, that's arguable given the somewhat surprising finale of Breaking Bad. But they're struggling to hold on to some kind of idea of competence and authority and manhood that has just been pulled out from under them. And so what I'm trying to say, in a way, in this piece is, if that is the case, which is perhaps a big if, what then do we do? What does the world look like? What do the stories that we tell and the characters that we produce out of that look like?
So what's the heart of your concern? And speak to a lot of listeners who didn't read your article. What are you most concerned about regarding us as a society of human beings, not just a society of TV watchers?
Right. I guess the personal genesis of this piece, in a way, which does come, there's a lot of pop culture obviously that feeds into it, and there I think most immediately a lot of movies that I've watched over the last 10 or 15 years about guys, mostly guys, who refuse to grow up. And the whole male refusal of maturity and adulthood and responsibility as the kind of the theme of American film comedy. But closer to home, you know, I just send my oldest kid off to college. I'm by any kind of actuarial or objective standard a grown-up person, and most of the time I don't feel like that, and I don't know even what that would mean. So it was partly, if there's a kind of personal or existential impulse behind this piece, it's just like, well, what would it mean now? What does it mean now to be a grown up? What is expected of you? What kind of prerogatives do you enjoy? What does it mean? And I just, it came out of this sense, this sort of intuition that there's no coherent answer or model. Now, whether or not there was one in the past is another question. But I wanted to just kind of look at the present and look, in a way, in the mirror of popular culture, of popular music, television, and movies, to kind of see how things look.
Just to put a point on what you were just referencing, the movies that stand in contrast to maybe those serious men in those TV shows, here's another montage.
All you can think about is toys.
They're not toys. This is Iron Man, okay? I got this when I was in second grade.
Didn't you touch my drum set?
Hey, knock it off.
Shampoo is better. I go on first and clean the hair.
I know you touched my drumstick, because the left one has a chip in it.
Conditioner is better. I leave the hair silky and smooth.
I'm just saying, when you're a guy, and you know, you have a family and you have responsibility, you lose that male camaraderie, and I get that. I totally understand where he's coming from.
Clips from The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Step Brothers, Billy Madison, Knocked Up, It's Adam Sandler's, and Judd Apatow's World, We're Just Living in It.
Yeah, I mean, that was a brilliant montage, and I like a lot of those movies quite a lot. Step Brothers, in particular, is very close to my heart. But yeah, there is, in these movies, and especially in film comedy, you know, I would say probably since the late 90s, the beginning of what French film critics like to call the new golden age of American comedy, this theme of regression or arrested development or just the kind of the active refusal of adulthood just keeps coming back again and again.
So, Emily Nussbaum, what did you think when you first read the article and after I don't know how many tweets back and forth? What do you think now?
My main feeling while reading the piece was, first of all, I have enormous respect for the large ambition of writing a manifesto that takes on so many different things and is intended clearly to create a conversation and to trigger discussion rather than to present only one idea. There were a lot of critiques that were made of the piece, many of which I agreed with, including, I know that you're saying that the piece doesn't conflate patriarchy and adulthood, but it's sort of an implicit danger in talking about it because it's about the question of, well, what counts as an adult and for who? And how does this model itself historically, and not just for men and women, but also for like many other communities, like, you know, what counts as adulthood among black men, among gay people, all that kind of thing. But actually, my main response to the piece was that, I mean, and this partially is because I'm a TV critic, is that I thought a lot about the way the piece potentially conflated something else, which is art that's about teenagers and art that is juvenile. And that is, to me, one of the tricky things about talking about this. I said this to Tony before, but I felt like within the piece was actually this completely legitimate essay that's just about being a movie critic and how frustrating it is to be a movie critic during
poor
a period.
Me.
Well, no, I love movies, but there is no denying the fact that, as you said very clearly in the piece, there's this economic center of the industry that's focused on movies that are either comic book movies or are meant for audiences that are very young or people might regard as juvenile in various ways. But in TV, and this is what I said in my last column, actually, the interesting thing to me is that it's almost the opposite. And I actually worry that people sometimes confuse shows about teenagers with shows that are immature and juvenile. And we were talking about the antiheroes, and a lot of times when people talk about the history of how did TV become so great and so sophisticated, they talk about The Sopranos. And why wouldn't they? That's a brilliant show. The truth is, My So-Called Life, Freaks and Geeks, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, these shows of the 90s, from my perspective and in my analysis of TV, are part of what triggered the greater sophistication of TV as a medium. But they were easy to ignore because they were about teenagers. Teenagers were watching them as well as adults. And the fact that they were actually more sophisticated than a lot of seeming adult shows was a little bit invisible. So when we're talking about this issue, I think it's important to sort of string apart the question of frustration within a medium of, you know, how adult, how sophisticated, how original, how boundary pushing is the art, and what is the art about? to me, part of the anxiety about a lot of art forms, and they include things that you're talking about as potentially juvenile art forms, everything from comic books to horror to young adult fiction, is to me the question you're thinking. I'm sorry, Sternberg.
I'm thinking millions of fantasy novel readers out there right now are listening to the radio and going, "Oh, no offense taken."
No.
I know you're not saying it pejoratively.
No, that's actually what I was going to say. Like, those forms are not intrinsically juvenile, but I think they create a lot of anxiety in the kind of cultural consumer that thinks of themselves as a sophisticate, because if you feel like you're reading or watching something alongside younger people, I think that that's part of the tension about young adult portrayals and things like that. And frankly, I just do take issue with the idea that there's a hierarchy in terms of all sorts of kind of degraded genres.
But one thing I would say to that I would push you on a little bit is that I mean I agree that all kinds of popular culture and all kinds of literature and all sorts of stories directed at all types of audiences and coming out of different impulses can be sophisticated and worthwhile and can last and can have value to anyone. But I think there's this idea, and this was an idea in Adam's piece too that he wrote on Vulture after my essay appeared, that there's this idea of a kind of stigma or a tension between the desire as an adult to experience and enjoy these things and some imagined disapproval. And I actually don't think that disapproval is very strong and functions very – I think that people don't have much of a problem or feel much of a sort of embarrassment about going to superhero movies or playing video games or reading young adult fiction.
In a way that you find threatening to our culture?
No, I don't find it threatening to the culture. I just don't like being identified as the threat. There's a sort of defensiveness, I guess, that comes into play here. So when you know, one as a critic sort of says that maybe there are not necessarily a hierarchy of forms, but a hierarchy of standards of quality. There's a sort of immediate counterattack that you're a snob or a scold or you're trying to spoil people's fun.
Now, Adam Sternberg from The New Yorker and wrote this on their from New York Magazine and wrote this on their Vulture site. It seemed to me that the centerpiece of your critique was that this is not new. This is actually one of the most consistent ideas in American history and American cultural history, that every generation laments that young people are not the grown-ups that we were.
Yeah, I think there's that's definitely part of it. I mean, I feel like this essay, like any good sprawling essay, there was much to agree with, much to disagree with, much to chew on. And I think it's important to delineate between identifying the ways in which adulthood is represented in culture, for example, the Seth Rogen knocked-up phenomenon, and talking about cultural consumption changes and the ways in which the audience's tastes and the, you know, what people are willing, what quote-unquote adults are willing to read, are willing to go see at the movie theater, are willing to watch on TV. And I feel like there is a kind of – it's funny you talk about this anxiety, and I don't think the anxiety comes from the audience. I don't think the person reading The Fault in Our Stars is sitting there saying, I'm enjoying this book, but what do critics think of me? But the critics, there are – you know, there is a sort of critical – reaction to that phenomenon, which says, hey, why is everyone reading this book that's supposed to be for kids? Come on, snap out of it. Let's grow up. Which I felt there was a strain of in your piece, maybe not a scolding strain, but a kind of wistful nostalgia for a time when people grew out of things and they realized that there was a, you know, you put the comic books away and you move on to your modern library set of matched classics and you never look back. And to me, that I feel like all of that anxiety is coming from the critical end, and it's a way of sort of trying to tell this mass audience of whatever, fantasy novels, graphic novels. I mean, Alison Bechdel just won a MacArthur Genius Grant, and there's still people in the critical establishment who don't take graphic novels seriously as a form. So to me, and that is, I think, a recurring generational conflict, is that each generation looks at the next generation and says, you're not serious enough. You need to grow up.
And, of course, movies were originally considered juvenile.
And so we're novels.
Yeah. And so we're novels. And all of these art forms move through these arcs where at the point that they're most powerful and most pleasurable, people consider them most dangerous, most potentially juvenile, and most addictive. And then when they're threatened, people talk about them as the very important objects of adult learning.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, one way of sort of inflecting what Adam was saying a little differently is that it's less a matter, I think, for me as a critic of kind of blaming the audience or sort of scolding people for liking what they like.
We were talking about Judd Apatow, who is often used as an example of someone whose films present this kind of man-child character who doesn't want to grow up. And yet, in a way, I think his movies, there's probably no American filmmaker more concerned with what is maturity, what is adulthood, what does it mean to be a grown-up? Does it mean you have to put on a suit every day or, you know, dress up for work? Does it mean you have to have a family? Does it, you know?
No, and that's the great value, I think, of his films. I mean, I'm not in any way, like, attack. I actually would make a distinction. There are some movies that I think kind of take an easy regressive. I mean, think of the Hangover movies, which are not movies I particularly admire, precisely because they just sort of, you know, wallow in it rather than seeing it, as Apatow at his best does, as a kind of problem, as exactly the conundrum that these characters face, which is how do I you know, grow up and still hold on to what matters to me and what I value about my friends or my freedom or my toys or whatever it is.
I strongly agree with that. And actually, it's part of why I do get a little frustrated with Apatow's movie sort of being treated as a punching bag exactly because what they're about is not the same thing as what they are, especially a 40-year-old virgin, which sometimes sort of gets thrown into this conversation as being about a man-child and therefore being a juvenile movie. But I actually remember, I'd have to see it again, being an incredibly thoughtful and empathetic movie specifically about this subject matter. But I do think that those kinds of movies frustrate people, and part of the reason is because there are just so many of them. And at a certain point, you stop distinguishing between the ones that are sort of just dopey fantasy versions of bro friendship mm-hmm. and movies that actually have something thoughtful to say. And it's just because people are just sated with the endless versions of this and just want to see something new. And I do think that's one of the things that you talk about in the piece very well, is the way in which a bunch of female comedy has come up to kind of do something that seems similar but is contextually a little bit different, simply because female roles in those movies have been limited to these extremely boring roles of the sort of mommy enforcer. And so to suddenly be the slutty, wild, strange, babyish, it's just a flood of oxygen into the idea of female comedy. And since comedy is about being childish and making a fool of yourself, women are not allowed to be funny unless they're allowed to do a lot of those kinds of things. So I think, especially on TV, it's been a very exciting time for female comedy in exactly those kinds of roles. But those shows are not unsophisticated shows.
Let me get a few of your readers into this conversation. My guest, if you're just joining us, our New York Times film critic, A.O. Scott, who wrote that long and widely shared piece in the magazine called The End of Adulthood, and a couple of other of our favorite local culture critics who have responded to it publicly, Adam Sternberg from New York Magazine and Emily Nussbaum from The New Yorker. You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hello, good morning. It's a very interesting discussion. I always enjoy reading about culture. But every period has its mass culture, pop culture, lowbrow culture, highbrow culture, its own literature, the genres. However, in our current time, I think that what we're really seeing is a major blockage for young adults negotiating the developmental tasks of adulthood because of problems on all levels, whether it's in the middle class with our student loan crisis, and whether it's in the working class with struggling for things we thought we'd already struggled for, or the poor with their underfunded families and broken families. The major issue for me is not what someone reads. They can read a comic book or they can read Mark Twain. I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about the economic barriers that we currently right. have in America and around the world that prevent people from negotiating developmental
Bob, thank you very much. In fact, the pushback article on Salon, if you saw it, was the end of adulthood is really about our broken capitalism.
Yeah, no, I think Bob, the caller, just put it very, very eloquently. And the some of my favorite responses have been exactly that, from Andrew here in Salon, kind of coming from the left, saying, well, this is capitalism. This is people, you know, who can't move out of their parents' house because they can't get good jobs. They can't pay back their student loans. And that's all very real. There have also been some very interesting from the right or more conservative and also from religious-based publications saying, well, the problem is the decline of religious authority. And this is, you know, it's not the death of adulthood. It's the abandonment of God. And those are just both really such interesting and powerful responses.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I wanted to make two quick points. I read the piece. It was thought-provoking, and these are some of my thoughts. Number one, please speak for yourself. If you meant the death of manhood, I wish you had said that, because there are plenty of us out here who are grown-ups and we are women. And the other comment is...
Emily just shook her hand as if to say, well, maybe.
Well, I'll speak for myself.
Go ahead.
But, I mean, adulthood was very misleading. The other thing is, it seems to me the comment that the complaint is more about what kind of movies get made, dopey Judd Apatow movies, rather than about us out here living our lives. And, yes, if they're only going to make dopey movies about childish men, it is harder to find a real one. I found one, but they are hard to find.
Or maybe it's the economics of the audience, and that's the only thing that people want to see, or primarily the thing that people want to see. Is that your point?
Well, it could be. I mean, I think to take the first point first, I mean, well, I don't ever speak for anyone but myself when I write, and I try to figure out what I think. But I think there is a section kind of toward the end of the piece where and Emily was just talking about this a minute ago with the women in comedy that I felt like was a very important part of the argument and of what's going on now, which is about the female revolt against adulthood, that is to say, against the narrow kind of constraining sorts of roles that women have been placed in these comedies and in American novels going all the way.
And you write in the article, just as the men pass through the stage of sincere rebellion to arrive at a stage of infantile refusal, so too have the women progressed by means of regression. After all, traditional adulthood was always the rawest deal for them. So, Emily, what were you reacting to when the caller was on?
Well, one thing is that I think there's a difference between movies and TV in this way. I'm not an expert on movies and can't really talk about the broad range of them, but I actually do agree that in movies, there, I mean, very straightforwardly, there aren't a lot of female movie makers, and there is a significant dearth of just strong, sophisticated subject matter about women in movies. It's very frustrating for people. TV is different, and not just because of comedy, but because there's an explosion of various different kinds of TV ambition, and it's not just in dirty comedies, which are great, right, but all over television, in the last few years especially, there's been, to me, this extremely exciting flowering not just of female TV creators, but also of just kinds of characters on shows ranging from The Good Wife to Enlightened.
Scandal?
Scandal is great.
Orange is the New Black. Yeah.
The Americans, 30 Rock, Parks and Recreation. I mean, you can't talk – when you talk about television, it's always a little hard to talk about because it's not any one thing. And although I liked the part of your essay in which you talked about the rise of the great dirty young women, including Amy Schumer and Broad City and Girls and all those kinds of shows, there's no way to summarize what's happening with women on television just by talking about them as analogous to the Judd Apatow man boy.
And
there's
agreed,
a lot of other agreed. Things happening.
We're already over time, but I want to get in one more caller who wants to bring up a particular television show, and you touch on the artist in your piece. Kareem in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kareem.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, I haven't read the article, and I understand that you mentioned Louis C.K. in the article, but one show that sort of emulates for me what it means to be a modern adult is Louis, and all of the sort of struggles that he faces, and the very sort of modern condition, almost postmodern condition that he finds himself in. And I'm just wondering what your guests think about that.
Tony? Well, I mean, Louis has a very pivotal place in the article, and it's a very complicated show and a very complicated character who is dealing exactly with the complications of trying to be a grown-up, of being, you know, a white man and a father, or at least a pale-skinned man and a father in a world where you know, all the sort of privileges and authority that would bring with it is at least suspect. And I identify with that character a lot, maybe more than is healthy, but I see quite a lot of my own confusion and dilemmas in his.
But you see Louis C.K. hanging it all on feminism.
Well, I think that one of the things that show is grappling with in a very honest way is the impact of feminism as something to be taken seriously, not as just something to be, mm-hmm. you know, dismissed or parodied. But that is the claims that women are making for their own equality and independence and dignity, and how those claims interact with his own assumptions about who he is and what he can do.
I love the show, Louis. I've written about it a lot, and it's endlessly enjoyable to argue about and think about. I had all sorts of complicated feelings about the last season, which actually dealt in a much – I mean, it moved into a much more serial storytelling place. It talked very frequently about his issues with women and questions of control, and I'm frankly still thinking about it. One thing I thought I'd mention, just because it always makes people mad, but – Girls and Louis, which are 2 half-hour, partially comic, partially dramatic shows, both of them by autobiographical artists with atypical chubby bodies who portray themselves as going through transitional periods in their life where they're trying to figure out what it would mean to be an adult, what it would mean to be an artist, and who use those bodies and the kind of humor on the show aggressively against the audience to make them uncomfortable and shake them up. I find those shows very analogous, obviously, and I find Lena Dunham and Louis C.K. quite analogous as artists. And in fact, the shows in some ways have reflected one another, but they're discussed in completely different contexts. And when we're talking about all these questions of adulthood, to me, the rich conversation comes out often not of comparing like things to like, but actually finding the connections between art forms that are often treated, you know,
really
girls is often talked about as like, it's women and female comedy, but these questions of identity are, I feel like we often
exist
get richer conversations
context.
When we see them in that bigger
Adam,
context.
Adam, you want to get in a last lick here?
Well, I think that's actually a very interesting comparison, and you know, one of the things that hasn't really come up in this conversation is the role of culture. Is the job of culture to teach us how to be adults, or is the job of culture to mirror back to us our anxieties, our struggles? Both of those shows do that for different demographics. And I do think it's interesting that we've come a very long way from Father Knows Best and these sort of cultural depictions of adulthood, which were very idealized, to what seems like a much more honest grappling with all of these anxieties.
So a tweet from Tiemann, who writes, listening to Brian Lehrer talking about what it means to be a grown-up while eating my oatmeal, how much more grown-up can I be? So we leave it there. You know, some segments on this show have a nice conclusion, and we wrap them up with a bow. Sometimes the conversation just has to stop in progress, and this is definitely one of those. So maybe you three will continue it at lunch while I have to do the rest of the show. But this has been great. I really appreciate all three of you coming in. And folks, if you haven't read the originating piece yet, it's The End of Adulthood by A.O. Scott in the New York Times. Just search End of Adulthood, and you will join an endless conversation that spreads out into many forms of social media. We also thank Adam Sternberg, who responded to the piece on New York Magazine's Vulture cultural site, and Emily Nussbaum from The New Yorker. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hold up. I'll be here forever. You know I'm on my fault. I ain't with foreclosure. I will never forfeit. Less than 4 bars. Google bring the chorus in. Did you get the picture yet? I'm painting you a portrait of young. I wanna be forever young, forever young.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the writer Anne Lamott. Stay with us. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Anne Lamott is with us now. Her stories and essays, her wit and insights have helped so many people through tough times and inspired us to good times. Maybe you've read Stitches or Help, Thanks, Wow, or Grace eventually. Anne Lamott's new book is called Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace in Our Everyday Lives. Anne, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you.
I thought we might focus mostly on your essay called Forgiven. You call forgiveness the hardest work we do. Can forgiveness really be harder than loss or decline or addiction?
Well, you don't have any choice really with loss or decline. And with the addiction, it's kind of controversial whether you do or not. But, oh, yeah, you know, for me, as a woman on a spiritual path, the two things you're supposed to be into are letting go and letting God and forgiveness. And those are my two weakest points. You know, if somebody says to me, let go and let God, I just want to smack them, you know. Obviously, if I could let go, I would be letting go. And then with forgiveness, oh, people say forgive and forget. And it just brings out the monster in me, because if I could forgive, I would. But also, I think forgiveness is the most important work we do. I think this earth here is kind of forgiveness school. I was 60 in April, and I thought I would be a lot better by now. And a lot of the books of Small Victories, a lot of the pieces tend to be about forgiveness, because it really is the single hugest miracle you can experience for your heart to be cold and clenched and all of a sudden to feel warmly towards someone who's hurt you.
And your first line in that chapter, Forgiven, is, I went around saying for a long time that I am not one of those Christians who are heavily into forgiveness, that I am one of the other kind. Ha. So how much are you being cute there?
Since I'm reform.
Christianity and Jesus have forgiveness pretty close to their core.
Yeah, I know. But I think a lot of people are faking it. And if you tell me that the far right-wing Christians of the Tea Party are heavily into forgiveness, I would laugh till I wept. And it's very hard work, because what it means is probably if you've been the one injured who needs to forgive, you need to re-experience the wound and how awful you felt and the shame someone caused you or the desolation and the rejection. And of course, in America, we're just taught to march ever onward and to stay one step ahead of the abyss and to not feel these really awful feelings. And in fact, maybe just go to IKEA and trick them out with a cute area rug. But the real work for me of healing and restoration involves horribly forgiving everyone. And when somebody that I have injured forgives me, I could die. I'm so grateful and so touched, because I know that they had to re-experience whatever harshness I brought onto them.
I heard you sneak the politics in there with your Tea Party reference, and I was going to read a few lines down in that chapter where you wrote, I tried to will myself into forgiving various people who had harmed me directly or indirectly over the years, four former Republican presidents, three relatives, two old boyfriends, and one teacher in a pear tree. It was the 12 Days of Christmas meets Taxi Driver. Ha. So interesting that you threw the four Republican presidents in there along with the old boyfriends.
Well, I believe that the end of the world in America that has led us to where we are now began with St. Ronald Reagan. And it took me a lot. You know, he was our governor. I'm from California. And he famously said, seen one redwood, seen them all. And he destroyed what was the greatest public education system in the country. And he threw all the people, many, many, many people with very severe mental illness, onto the streets because of, you know, trickle-down economics and rising boats or whatever. And anyway, don't get me started. And then we had George Herbert Walker Bush, who I think, looking back, was not quite as destructive as say, then his son, and who is, out on a book tour side by side with me. So it's all sort of interesting. And I'm really crushed and devastated by what this country does to its poor and does to its elderly and does to its children. And I'm an activist, so what can I say? Yeah. I'm a little tense on the subject, yeah.
You know, I recently did for the show an analysis of all the ideological political books that made it to number one on the Times nonfiction bestseller list in the last 25 years. And there were 38 conservative books by, you know, Bill O'Reilly and people like that. And just 17 liberal books. So conservatives read. And I was going to ask you, does it hurt your book sales to be unabashedly anti-Republican when you're otherwise a Christian self-help author?
A self-help author. Yeah.
How would you call it?
Go ahead. I would say that I'm a person writing essays about what happens when we very, very human and vulnerable people step on the cosmic banana peel and go down and really need a lot of help getting back up. But anyway, I take your point, and I can't tell. I know fundamentalist Christian bookstores don't carry my work. I realized that with Traveling Mercies, which was probably 15 or more years ago. And when I was out on tour for that and in the South, people would call in and they'd say, "Well, Miss Lamott, I just wonder how witty you think you're going to be when you're rotten in hell for all eternity." So I will say, well, thank you for sharing, and you get to think what you think. But I don't actually think it hurts my sales. And people come up to me wherever I am, and they say, "Oh, I know you don't have a lot of us conservatives." But, you know, I have two friends, passionately close friends, who are conservatives. And we just don't talk about it, you know.
And I saw your tweet.
You don't talk about God or politics, yeah.
Other than that, you talk about everything. I saw your tweet this morning that said, "I don't care if people don't buy small victories, if they don't like my positions on immigration or women's rights." So
that's right.
You put
this
it
side of
there.
The grave, I'm going to be marching for women's rights. And it's just the way I came. And I came by this honestly. My parents were left-wing activists too. But of course, they were atheists. So I guess it skipped a generation.
And Dave in Greenwich, you're on WNYC with Ann Lamott. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much. And Ann, I just want to say, I have valued all of your work. Bird by Bird was a massive move forward for me in writing. And as you were talking about forgiveness, it occurs to me that forgiveness is the greatest gift that we can give to ourselves, because it separates us from all that poison, like drinking the poison and hoping the other person dies.
Yeah.
It is truly a freeing
drinking
force.
The rat poison. Yeah, it's drinking the rat poison and thinking the rat will die. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's the hardest work we do and the most profound spiritual effort we can make, and will bring with it the greatest increase. But again, it's easier said than done, and I have needed a lot of help.
Dave, thank you.
But thank you. That's very sweet. Yeah.
So, we talked a little bit about you throwing the right-wingers under the bus. We have a lot of secular listeners who probably think, that Ann Lamott, she is so smart and sarcastic and sophisticated, but she still clings to that religion stuff as a frame. Why someone like her? What would you say to those people?
Well, I would say that we're very, very complex as a species, and we're beautiful, and we're screwed up, and we're a very violent species, and Cain is still killing Abel, and I have all that inside of me, and I have this incredible tenderness and gentleness towards the world, and the information and truth doesn't come in on bumper stickers. So the religious or spiritual followers I have hate that I'm so political, and the left-wing or liberal progressive people that really like my work and my activism hate that I'm religious. So what are you going to do?
Michelle,
it's really none of my business. Yeah.
Michelle in Yorktown Heights, you're on WNYC with Ann Lamott. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, how are you? Ann, I really wanted to tell you that your book, Operating Instructions,
saved my life when I had my first baby. I read it probably 16 years ago, and there's still things that make me laugh out loud about, like, being in the shower with your underwear on and your brother eating, like, many pots of rice because you were trying to make rice water for your son's colic.
I've forgotten all that.
I'm a labor and delivery nurse, and I recommend your book to my patients all the time. So there's that. And then second, I wanted to thank you for writing the Rosie novels. I adore Rosie. I hold a little piece of her with me all the time. And now I have a 14-year-old I'm nervous. I'm never starstruck, Anne. I just adore you. And I have my daughter reading your books, too, and we're just huge fans. Thank you for doing what you do.
Well, thank you. I know you didn't ask for advice, and I love your thoughts and kindness, but I would really read the book I wrote with Sam called Some Assembly Required, which is a follow-up to Operating Instructions, because it's really about being the mother of a growing or grown child and how you have to release these children to their own holiness path and their own hero's journey. You really at some point can't run alongside them with juice boxes and chapstick trying to get them to do exactly what you're positive would be the best possible course of action. So Some Assembly Required is really about letting go, you know, and of course we always say whatever we let go of, in my case, has claw marks on it. But I do have tiny, tiny, tiny control issues, and they were at their worst when I had a teenage son. So maybe that book would give you some ideas. For instance, there's one acronym in it called WAIT, W-A-I-T. Why am I talking? Since it just seems to aggravate them. And they're not interested in your opinions and your tiny thoughts on what they're wearing. And so I've been walking around saying WAIT for about 10 years now.
Michelle, thank you for calling. Kimberly in Asheville, North Carolina. You're on WNYC with Ann Lamott. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi. I am just so grateful to you, Ms. Lamott. I've never called into anything before, never spoken to a writer I admired before, but I have to tell you, you just changed my life. I was raised in a liberal Baptist church in New Jersey, moved down south with a very strong faith, and just got completely turned off by the politics that were so intertwined with the churches here and didn't mesh with mine. As much as I tried to make that work, it didn't. Was heavily into Y2K and decided December 31st, 1999, I was going to sit down and read your book as a little treat for myself. And it just completely validated my feelings that I could still have a relationship with my God. And, you know, the churches didn't matter, the politics, you know, that was just irrelevant. Thank you. And Operating Instructions as well. My 19-year-old was pregnant with a child when that book came out, and that just was such a blessing, too. So you give voice to a lot of people, and I turn everybody that I love in my life onto your books because there's just so much truth there.
Oh, and Anne, you say you're not a self-help author.
I'm not a self-help author. No, I'm definitely not. I tell the truth, though. I'm a truth teller. And the hugest experience spiritually you can have with another person is for them to listen and to say, me too. So when I wrote Operating Instructions, which was 1992, there hadn't been women mothers coming out yet and saying that it really wasn't lining up with what they'd seen on TV and that they were a little tiny bit more anxious and angry than they thought they'd be and that they were so wasted with exhaustion that they were thinking about leaving the baby outside just for the one night, nicely bundled up with the dog so that they could get one night's sleep. And when I said that, people cried and they said, me too, because no one would ever admit it before. So I think I tell a truth, and it's like chemotherapy. It is for me when someone tells the truth. But anyway, I don't think that's a very – that's not a point that I'm going to belabor. If you think I'm a self-help, I mean, I love helping people. But what I want to say to this woman was I always think that my biggest fans are ministers, rabbis, and lesbians. But it turns out that the people that really I think I'm helpful to is people that grew up in really awful fundamentalist or hypocritical religious families and communities where it was just so much of it was a crock, you know, because you heard people spout scripture and trash the wife or be unfaithful or hurt the children. And so My point or my position is that everybody gets to think what they want, but if you find a way of connecting with some higher power, some power greater than yourself, or some unseen reality that feels as real as what you can see, that's all we're talking about here. It's like a lot of my friends, or actually one of my friends, always calls God Howard because she's Jewish and very secular, but she has been so helped by what I would dare to call grace that she says, "Our Father who art in heaven, Howard be thy name." And so she's always talking about, boy, Howard came through. So I just don't think it matters what you call God or if you can get everything to line up nicely with something that some aging white man tells you is true about yourself. It's just about finding yourself. It's finding your way to your own heart and your own heart cave. You know, that's what women want. That's what we want.
Anne Lamott with us on WNYC. Her new book is Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. Can you talk about the concept of grace? You had that bestseller, Grace Eventually, and the subtitle of this book is Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. What is grace?
Oh, Brian. You know, it takes whole books for me to say, but in the Christian tradition, they would say that it was unmerited help. I would say that it is a form of spiritual WD-40 where you're very stuck and your thinking is bad. Your thinking is the ping pong game of self-loathing and narcissism. And you are in a very grippy, clenched state of kind of madness. And you get the spritz of the WD-40 and you can breathe again. Or miraculously, you get your sense of humor back. That's when I know grace has arrived. I've always said laughter is carbonated holiness. And when I can laugh again, when someone can make me laugh, when I get a very friendly sense of humor back about myself, I feel like that's what we're talking about. You could say grace is like water wings if you're in water where you're a little frightened that you might go down, or very frequently a second wind when you can't go on. Or we think you can't go on, you're used up and you hate everyone. Mm. And all of a sudden, there's a little bit of wind in your sails. And for me, a lot of it has to do with surrender because I have a disease of good ideas. I'm almost positive that my ideas are the very best possible course of action for almost everyone, including everybody listening to your show today. And, you know,
Like most guests.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
But I remember once I was going to Africa, and I asked I have a tiny little church of about 30 people, and I asked them for prayers because I'm afraid of, you know, I don't really believe in flying, and I was pretty afraid about, I'm pretty afraid of snakes. And I asked for prayers, and my pastor said, you know, when you're on a plane, it's a little late for beggy prayers, and it's really time for trust and surrender. And when the plates of the earth shift beneath me and I go from clenched and tight and slightly, you know, bitter to feeling this kind of surrender and trust, that to me is the movement of grace in my life.
And you did that so well. What about faith? What does faith even mean to someone who writes about life's toughest emotional hardships? Faith that what?
Well, faith that it's going to be pretty much semi sort of okay if we just keep helping each other get back up. I know I have absolute faith that I stopped drinking 28 years ago. I have absolute faith that if I don't drink or use today, everything is going to be semi sort of okay. I have absolute faith that if I'll just bust myself gently when I'm in my most toxic thinking and pick up the 200-pound phone and call a girlfriend or a guy and tell them the truth, that they will listen and they will say those words, me too, yep, I get it, I'm not there today, but I know what it's like, can I get you a cup of tea, that I'm going to experience some measure of mental healing. All my problems are thinking, it's like a ticker tape of anxiety and domination and control and victimization and self-righteousness. And when I listen to someone and they hear me and we start to laugh again, I'm able to let go of that and to have that faith that the things, you know, things don't have to make sense for there to be meaning in our lives. You know, humanity is meaningful, and figure it out is not a good slogan. But usually I need to call someone for them to remind me of this. And then I can breathe again and I go, oh, right. You know, I'll do radical self-care. I'll have some M&Ms. I'll take the dog for a walk. I'll get the new issue of People magazine, all the various spiritual sacraments, the sacrament of plop and of letting go and letting down and, you know, watching Survivor. And I have faith that it will pass.
That was great. Julie in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Anne Lamott. Julie, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And I love your books, and you've made me almost Catholic again. But
Wait, Anne, aren't you Presbyterian or something? Anne?
I am. I'm a nice Protestant girl, but I do wear a Mary around my necklace. But go ahead, honey. I'm listening.
Thank you. Here's my question. It's kind of a biggie. The reason I'm almost Catholic again is I can see grace in my life everywhere. But what I can't reconcile is all the suffering of babies and disasters and disease and the ghastly things that are happening to people every day. You know, my life is a cakewalk. And how does this work? Because I'm not really better than those people. So what's the story?
I know. It's a question people have been unable to answer for our entire stay here on this funny blue marble. How can this be right? How do we even live in the face of it? But with my last book, Stitches, I began it on the Friday after the shootings at Newtown because I was going to be teaching Sunday school in 2 days. And I tell my little ones and my teenagers that they are loved and chosen and it's a come as you are party and that they're safe. And if they don't feel safe, come find one of us. And we'll sit there in it with them and help walk them through. And so Stitches might be a book. I don't know if you've read it, but it's really about where we find meaning in just catastrophe and the suffering of children, the suffering really of 90% of the world and how we go on. And how, there's one story I'll tell you, and then I'm probably about to get the hook. But when I was starting to write Stitches, I thought, where can you even start after Sandy Hook? And I remembered Barry Lopez, the great novelist, saying that sometimes we need a story more than we need food, and that also when all is said and done, all we really have are compassion and stories. So I thought of this one story my pastor told about this war horse that comes upon a little sparrow lying by the side of the road with its legs sticking straight up, and the war horse, who I always picture as Donald Rumsfeld, makes this huge snorting, neighing warhorse laugh and says, what are you up to? And the sparrow says, well, I heard that the sky is falling and I wanted to help. And the horse just kept laughing and says, you really think you're going to hold back the darkness with those skinny little legs? And the sparrow says, one does what one can. And so I showed up, I fed my children at Sunday school. We did arts and crafts. We gathered granola bars and water. We distributed it to the homeless. You know, Mother Teresa said, none of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. I pick up litter, you know. I'll go around the neighborhood and I'll pick up litter. And one does what one can. And I know what it feels like. And you just got to have faith that if you do a few small gestures of kindness, you flirt with the old people at the health food store. You share your, you know, in India, in America, we're storing up all these bananas and they're all going bad because we can't get enough. And in India, you see people lying in the street and they break off the banana they have and they share it with the person next to them. So the law of the American jungle is share your bananas.
Share your bananas. And since we can't possibly top that, we will give you the hook, as you called it. How's that for no good deed goes unpunished? You tell a great story with a great ending and you get ushered out the door. Anne Lamott, thank you so much. Latest book,
Thank you, Brian.
Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. Everybody feels better now.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Al Michaels next, the legendary sportscaster. His new book, You Can't Make This Up. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is the sportscaster Al Michaels, best known these days as the voice of Sunday Night Football on NBC, TV's highest rated show, except for the last few weeks. We'll get into that. For many years, he did Monday Night Football on ABC when that was the biggest game of the broadcast week, and he's done the Miracle on Ice Olympic hockey game where the U.S. beat the Soviets in 1980, and lots of Major League Baseball, including the moment during the 1989 World Series when the earthquake hit San Francisco, and he was forced to transform himself from a sports announcer into a very rattled newsman. Al Michaels' memoir out now is called You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. Al, big fan. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, longtime listener, first-time caller. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. As a New York station, we'll start by noting you're a local kid, and chapter one is called Brooklyn. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Flatbush on Ocean Avenue between Albemarle and Beverly. The train station would be the Church Avenue station. Flatbush Avenue, a couple of blocks away, and probably a 15-minute walk over to Ebbets Field, so right in the heart of the borough.
What was it like being a kid Dodgers fan as they were losing almost all those World Series to the Yankees in that string of years in the early 50s, but kept making it to the World Series? Do you have memories of that?
I sure do. And it was a different sport, obviously, at that time, and now there are over 30 teams, and at that time, there were only eight in each league, Brian, so you had no playoffs. If you won the pennant, you went straight to the World Series. It was a straight shot. And, you would take a little bit of grief from Yankee fans, but as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, if you were a Yankee fan, nobody wanted to admit it. So we were all despondent together. It was collective despondency through those years, but we got our due in 1955, finally.
Right. You know, even though sports isn't considered an intellectual pursuit, to me the best announcers aren't afraid to sound smart. You're one of those. Also, your old baseball partner on ABC, Tim McCarver. Is it something you talk about with each other, like how analytical to be and when it's too little or too much?
Well, we do talk about it, and it's evolved very much through the years. I think the template is a little different right now. Years ago when I was growing up, you pretty much did the game, and you didn't add very, very much to the game in terms of the fellows who were announcing at that particular point. But then there was Red Barber, who was obviously very well read, erudite, and he may have begun the era of maybe guys sounding a little smarter. And then through the years with television and people learning more about the games, now I think the key is not to be too over-analytical. I mean, I'll watch some games from time to time, and I'm thinking that I'm watching a football clinic. I don't want to be in a clinic. I want to enjoy the game and the pageantry and the excitement and the drama. I don't need to hear about a double A-gap blitz every 15 seconds.
Yeah. How about how excited to get? You mentioned Red Barber. He was so low-key. Vince Scully is pretty low-key. Some guys scream and scream. How do you calibrate that for yourself, and what's right for you?
I think in the book, Brian, one of the things I talk about is I think of the game as a melody, and we are doing the lyrics, and the lyrics have to match the melody. You have to make it comfortable for the listener. I think you can go over the top with things, and that's bad. You can also understate things. If things get really heated and you are too understated, that can be disconcerting to the audience as well. So I think you have to feel the game. You have to feel where it is. And, you know, as a kid growing up and going to so many games before I ever started to do it, I think I have a great innate sense of the rhythm of where a game is at any particular point. And all I'm really trying to do is match the moment. Don't overwhelm it. Remember that the game is the star. You're not the star. You're there as an ancillary figure. You're there to, I wouldn't say embellish things, but to, you know, maybe make the game more entertaining. You can be informative. You can be enlightening. But don't overstep the boundaries there. Just try to match what's going on, match the mood.
All right, I'm going to play one of your own home run calls. See if you can identify the moment.
Oh, I have a feeling what's coming.
drops down and it's drilled to deep left center field, and Jose Canseco on a 2-2 pitch has hit it out. A 3-run home run, and it's 7-3 Oakland.
You know it, right?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking of a couple of other home run calls that you may have given me, but that I believe was from the World Series of 89.
It was. It was just before the earthquake.
It was probably the game before the earthquake, because the earthquake took place before Game 3 even started.
Right, so the game before the yes.
That was Game 2 on Sunday night in Oakland. Yeah,
and I guess I played that one because it didn't have a particular home run call. And I wonder if you've developed a home run call. I know you're not doing baseball these days. And whether you think that's a good thing to do. And, you know, some guys, you know how they're going to call the home. It is high, it is far, it is gone, whatever. And did you have a home run call?
I didn't. Because growing up, and I probably patterned myself a little bit after Vin Scully in that regard. Because I remember, you know, when Vinny started with the Dodgers and he was the number three guy on a broadcast team that included Red Barber and Connie Desmond, and Vinny oftentimes, and still to this day, will say she is gone, and that's not really a signature call, but he'll call it in varying ways. And, you know, when I pretty much patterned myself after his style, I didn't come up with a home run call. I didn't think it was necessary. I don't mind it, and especially in the Midwest, there are a lot of announcers through the years, Harry Carey, Bob Prince, who were iconic figures in Chicago, and Harry in St. Louis as well, and Bob in Pittsburgh, who had calls, and they become part of the fabric. And I think that's a good thing. I think you have to know what your audience wants. But for me, and especially Brian, once I went to national television, I don't think you need a home run call. I think I'm not saying you have to call it down the middle, but it's more neutral. And plus, every home run is a different shape and size. Some barely get over the fence. Some are, you know, 500-foot blast into the upper deck. Some are inside the park. So one size doesn't fit all.
And I'm curious how different it is for you. And I think you've done all four major sports. So you did some NBA.
Oh, yes.
So I know you did hockey in the Olympics, baseball, football. How different is it to call a baseball game from a football game?
Well, first of all, there's a big difference between radio and television to start with. That's the key. Baseball on radio is wonderful because you're afforded the opportunity to really paint pictures, to use verbs, because obviously the listener can't see the game, but you can make them feel the game. And baseball is the best of the radio sports. Football's pretty good on radio, too. Football on television, we've now reached the point where the play-by-play announcer pretty much calls the play, and maybe I will start some rudimentary analysis to bring my current partner Chris Collinsworth in to facilitate his entry into his analysis. And we try to make it a little conversational. We don't try to overtalk, but there are distinct differences with all of the sports. And if people have asked me what would be the toughest is hockey on radio, because you can see a baseball game in your mind's eye. I mean, one team is at bat, the other's in the field. In football, one team has the ball, the other team's playing defense. In basketball, you know the teams are going up and down the court. But in hockey, possession is always changing. It's ever-changing. There's very little scoring. And I think the guys who do hockey on radio really have the toughest task of all, because that is a hard game to see in your mind's eye.
Howard in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Al Michaels. Hi, Howard.
Hi. I was going to ask Al, because one of his signature things is the ice hockey. You know, do you believe in miracles? If before a game he creates what could be a potential signature call, you know, for the moment.
Well, I don't, because I've always felt that if you do, it will sound scripted and might not match the moment, and I guess I've learned through the years, having done this for so long, to just trust my instincts and to feel it. And I know in Lake Placid, not only did I not think about what I was going to say at the end of the game, I was expecting the Soviets to win the game by a final score of something like 10-2. there was that much disparity with those teams. All I was hoping for was that the game would stay relatively close to midway through the second period. So when I say what I did, it was from the heart. And somebody once wrote, it was probably the 9-year-old in me coming out, and I'll buy that.
And here are the last 33 seconds of that ice hockey match.
28 seconds. The crowd going insane. Karlamov shooting it into the American end again. Morrow is back there. Now Johnson, 19 seconds. Johnson over to Ramsey. Will you let them off? Gets checked by Ramsey. McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game.
Do
you believe in miracles? Yes!
Unbelievable.
I'm getting chills just hearing it now. Again, and I heard it a half hour before the show to get it ready. Did that just pop out? Do you believe in miracles?
It did. And what happened was, I mean, the game was so surreal in that, you know, the U.S. wins, obviously, but they come from behind three different times. They erase three deficits. They're outshot 39-16, so the Soviets really dominated play. The American goalie, Jim Craig, was over the moon, phenomenal. And then the U.S. was able to get two quick goals in the third period. And then the last 10 minutes of the game, it felt as if the clock was in quicksand. And then at the end of the game, all I'm thinking about is just I'm trying to call the game to the end. Because if you think of something and then you want to blurt it out, and let's say the Soviets had put a little extra pressure on you on the U.S. team, I mean, can you imagine Brian coming up with something like that? And in the process, or at that particular point, the Soviets were to have scored a goal.
Right.
So how stupid would that have sounded? So what happened at the end of that game is that with about 6 seconds left, when the puck comes out to center ice, it affords me that one moment where, hey, it's over right now. They're not going to bring the puck back into the American zone and score. And there was a word that popped into my head, and it was miraculous. And miraculous somehow got morphed into a question, and that's how "Do you believe in miracles?" popped out. I answered it with a yes, and just let the pictures play for a while.
Sunday Night Football is usually the highest-rated show on television. How much do you think football is threatened by the backlash against concussions and other injuries? I know more and more people who say they still watch football because they grew up with it, but they wouldn't let their kids play the sport in high school anymore or even feel guilty now watching a football game.
It's a very big issue, and the league is obviously very well aware of it and doing everything they can to try to make it safer, to deal with this. On a medical level, there's no question about that. I think what's happened, Brian, is that fans are able to compartmentalize this. On one hand, they know this exists. They know it's an issue. It's serious, and it needs to be dealt with. On the other hand, I think they get to Sunday or Saturday in college football, and they say, you know what? I want some entertainment, and I want my football, because the ratings have really not diminished.
Yeah.
Now, will they down the line? That's the big question right now. But for the moment, I think the fans are able to say, hey, I know there are issues. They're over here, and maybe I'll think about them during the week. But on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, I want to watch my football game.
Can you tell from the broadcast booth or from the other close-up contact that you have if football has actually gotten more violent over the years? I've read that the players are bigger, the hits are harder and louder. They train differently for that than they did 20, 30 years ago, that it's literally a more dangerous game today. Do you think that's true?
Well, all that is true. I mean, every sport is played faster, with stronger people, people who have better nutrition, people who are trained better. When we go back to, you know, when I'm a kid, if you played for the Dodgers, you sold insurance or you sold cars in the off season. You had another job. And then, of course, it became full-time, it became a big money endeavor, all sports. And then these guys are training all year long. And everybody's trying to get an edge, and everybody's trying to be bigger and stronger, and some have even cheated their way to that point. And again, that's something that all of the leagues have been trying to regulate, and they've done a pretty good job at it. Not that some guys don't slip through the cracks, but obviously you have you have human beings who are taller, stronger, more muscle mass, faster. And so naturally, you put all of this together in a compact environment like 100 yards by 53 and a third yards, and you're going to get some hellacious hits. So it is played on a more, I guess, violent level, to put it that way, but it's also with, you know, better protection. You go back and you look at some of those films with leather helmets and very little padding. Well, maybe they weren't playing as fast and as violently, but you could get hurt just as seriously.
We've got 1 minute left. Let me throw in one other memory at random here to get your take on. What was the Dennis Miller experiment like on Monday Night Football when they brought a comedian into the booth to try to spice things up? They didn't have Howard Cosell anymore. They didn't have Don Meredith anymore. So they brought in an actual comedian who was a sports fan.
It was wild. It was fascinating. I had a ton of fun with Dennis. The show needed a little bit of a boost at that point. He provided it. It got everybody around the country talking about it again, and on that level, it was great. The thing, if Dennis didn't resonate with some people, a lot of comedy is visual. And if you saw Dennis in concert or watched him on the HBO show, and he told a joke, and then you would watch him either look confused, which was, you know, a part of his act, or have a certain look, or the way his eyes would move, you would laugh. But if you're doing a football game and you're trying to throw a line in with the crowd screaming and the game going people are going, what did he say?
Yeah, it got lost.
So that was the issue.
Yeah. You know, Sunday Night Football has been replaced as number one in its time slot in recent weeks by the AMC show Walking Dead. So you're being beaten by a bunch of zombies.
Oh, I'll believe that when I see it.
Other than that, you're still number one. Al Michaels, You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
A lot of fun, Brian. Thank you.